On today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast, Julie Klo explains the need for a work revolution. Welcome to the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. I'm Jay Frosting. I'm joined today by Julie Klo, the author of The Work Revolution. Julie, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I'm about 36-ish, and I've never been particularly satisfied with many of the jobs that I've had, but I didn't know if that was a widespread problem or if it was, you know, just related to me. Would you say that people are less satisfied with work in the last, 30 years? And if so, you know, how would we measure that? How would we know for sure?
You know, it's a good question. And I can't say that I have any statistical data to point to job satisfaction then versus now. Anecdotally, I can say that, you know, I remember my parents not being particularly happy with any of their jobs early on. My mom did some exploration and ended up finding something she really loved. But I felt like that was more of the exception rather than the rule. So I feel like it's not that we have gotten more miserable since then, or it's qualitatively different, but I think what is different is that we are in a new age where we are feeling much more overwhelmed now than ever before, simply because of the oversaturation of information and the fact that we are global now, and we have colleagues on the other side of the planet. Therefore, work is happening 24 hours a day. So I think that is fundamentally different than what my parents had to deal with, and so it kind of compounds the whole issue is if you're not happy with your job and you're feeling overwhelmed, it's kind of a double whammy.
Okay. Yeah, that's a very good point. There have been times in my life, you know, speaking anecdotally, that I've felt overwhelmed with information and it seemed like I had to make an extra effort and just increase my self-discipline to not expose myself to so many RSS feeds or Twitter accounts or whatever the delivery mechanism of the day. But I guess that not everybody has the option for turning some of that off in their daily jobs.
Right. Oh, and I'm sure that it varies by job also. So in some cases, you may have the option to turn those things off. And in other instances, it may be core to what you're doing in terms of your work and the need to actually gather this information from all these different sources. So I think the variation is pretty wide.
One of the, more obvious examples you gave in the book was, you get to work first thing in the morning and you spend the first hour looking at emails that have built up overnight because stuff does happen 24/7 and responding to them. And obviously that cascades throughout the day and the rest of the organization and people aren't getting as much done as a result because there's just all this back and forth instead of more streamlined communication options.
Yep, absolutely. No, I agree. And I think it's just more stilted kinds of work. You know, it's a high interruption, a lot of context changes. And, you know, productivity gurus talk about this ad nauseum. I mean, it's a major issue. It does affect your focus. And, you know, when you are constantly pestered with communications that are in and out, it's hard to find that flow. It's really hard to find that pure joy in doing that kinds of work that just feels like it never ends.
Just tactically speaking, one thing that worked for me was to only look at my email every, hour or 2 hours maybe. But I was definitely in a minority there and people sort of thought I was crazy for not responding to or at least acknowledging everything that came in as it came in.
Right, absolutely. And the expectation is instantaneous communication. And so people tend to look at you crazy if you do set those boundaries. But I think that part of our quest in terms of, you know, work-life blending and finding that right balance is starting to set some of those boundaries and listening to our energy and saying, hey, you know, I am feeling overwhelmed right now. I need to shut it off and just walk away from it for a little while.
And you wrote in the book, in order to rewrite the rules, it's important to get crystal clear on our reality. I like to think of this as a math equation. Could you tell us what that equation is?
I think in terms of very analytical metaphors. And so when I was sitting down to write the book, I felt like we are following rules right now that were written many, many years ago. And those rules kind of just don't work for us anymore. The rules are based on things like assembly lines, where it was important for people to show up at the same time of day in order for the assembly lines to run. But those rules persisted despite the fact that assembly lines are not the major form of work that we do these days. So when I was thinking about it, I was like, well, wait a minute. You know, we do have a new reality. And so if we step back to say, what are the constants? You know, if we accept the fact that information is coming in 24 hours a day, if we accept the fact that we are a global society now, then let's start with that as kind of the constants in our math equation. And then let's rethink the whole equation. Let's then play with the variables a little bit and say, what might we do differently given the fact that these are our constants, given the fact that we have many more demands now in our time than ever before, given the fact that there is so much variability between the kinds of families we have now versus a very traditional family structure in generations past, and the fact that, you know, a lot more people are choosing to be single or choosing to have children later in life. There are so many variabilities in our situations that it seems crazy that we can't play with that variability to create more flexibility for people and more freedom, you know, to follow what it is we personally need for our own situations while still satisfying, you know, the needs of our work environments and what our organizations need from us.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second and say, you know, I'm a small business owner and I can't allow people to set their own schedule because I need to make sure that if somebody sets a 9 a.m. meeting that everybody they want to be in the meeting will be there.
Right, absolutely. So I think that, again, it's important to question the assumptions behind it.
Yeah.
First of all, does a meeting need to be at 9 o'clock? Second of all, do we need to have this meeting? What's important about it? Perhaps it's completely superfluous. Third, what might work best for the people who are involved with that meeting? And if everybody's morning people and they really like to kickstart it by getting together and being on the same page, then by all means, go for it. It may make perfect sense for there to be a 9 o'clock meeting. I think that the premise that I've introduced in the work revolution is getting clear on this notion of true urgency. And true urgency means there are some things that are critically important in the job environment that we pay attention to. Customer needs are important. Retail store hours are important. Demand for customer service based on what kinds of service you're offering, there are going to be peaks, natural peak times when customers need help.
Right.
So paying attention to these truly urgent things and then working schedules around that, I think, makes much more sense than just drawing a very broad stroke to say, hey, we should all show up at 9 just because that'll be convenient for all of us. Convenient, sure, but maybe inconvenient in the sense that I'm not a morning person and I'm going to be half alive at 9 a.m., you know, and other people may feel differently.
You also wrote in the book that, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, we're accustomed to the principle of hard work, especially in the U.S., since we are founded on Puritan principles of suffering. That we've completely overlooked the notion that easy often points the way to right. Does that mean that we, even if it's just subconsciously, seek out in a sort of masochistic way, like the worst way to go about something?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the word work implies somewhat of an unpleasant sort of task. And I think because we have that connotation associated with work, we've slipped into believing that we can't find joy from that. And I actually don't believe that's true. I think that we can find joy from work. I think that we can play while we're doing work. Because if we're doing things we're passionate about, if we're doing things that really play to our talents and our strengths, then we could get very energized from that. We can be very excited by the impact that we're bringing. So I think that when, you know, the whole notion of flow, you know, so this is the positive psychology trend. This notion of flow is one where time is just floating along and it goes so quickly you don't even realize that it's flying by. And that's easy. You know, that is what I would characterize as easy. Not easy in the, it's so easy you don't have to think about doing it. No, it's easy in the sense that you can just let yourself go with it and really get some amazing stuff done and you know, reach great accomplishments through that. But the whole notion of hard work, we tend to see that as like sweat and tears and blood and
right.
just have this really like brute force mentality about it.
Like exercise.
Right, exactly. Exercise.
Something after which we can congratulate ourselves for doing, but we don't enjoy it and we don't look forward to it.
That's exactly right. And I think that we just really have to start questioning that assumption about work in general and say, hey, does it have to be this bad? Do we really have to torture ourselves for 8 or 10 or 12 hours a day? You know, what if we didn't and what would that look like?
And for our listeners that might not have heard of the flow concept before, it's been a while since I read that book. I'm not sure that I finished it, to be honest, but flow is the midpoint between something that is easy and boring and really brand new and challenging and sort of hurts your brain to try to work on the problem.
Right. I think that's actually a pretty good summary of it. I'm not an expert in positive psychology or flow for that matter. I'm just a fan of the concept. But I think that we can all personally relate to that in one form or another. When you get good at something, you really enjoy that because you feel like you have mastered something and that it comes much easier than if you're in the process of trying to learn it one step at a time. So I like to think of flow as being fully in that mastery piece of it, but then challenging yourself to take it one step further.
Okay.
Challenging your brain, challenging your skills in some way, just so that you are fully engaged in that process.
There's a very comprehensive quiz in the book, sort of reminiscent of the, you know, find out if he really likes you sort of thing from a ladies magazine. But this is much more serious and down to earth. It covers things like deadlines and perks and hours to leadership and many other aspects of your current job in order to find out, you know, just how poorly or well your employer rates and how to focus on making things better in the future. How did you decide which details to use for that? Was it mostly personal experience, or did you do a lot of, you know, interviewing of your friends? Or?
Well, I think it was mostly due to my experience. I sat down essentially and wrote out a lot of the activities that I noticed in traditional corporations,
yeah.
Which I did work in a traditional company for 6 years and did contracting work for a few years in a wide variety of organizations, all of which were traditional. And then, of course, working at Google, I took note of the things that were vastly different from that. You know, the dress code is the easy thing to point to. There is no dress code at Google.
Mm-hmm.
Versus all the other organizations I worked for, you know, it was business casual and you couldn't wear open-toed shoes and you had to wear pantyhose on a 90-degree day and, you know, just crazy silly rules that made no intuitive sense. So I started with the obvious things. You know, what are the obvious things in the workplace that once I went to Google, I felt that profound sense of freedom in having choices and in having leaders who respected me for the talents that I brought. So that was the starting place for it. And then when I wrote the book, I developed 5 guiding principles that, to me, sum up the difference between a traditional work environment and a freedom-based job environment like Google. And those 5 principles are ultimately what rooted or anchored the quiz in the book. So there are questions related to impact, not activities. So to what extent is your company focused on the activities that people are doing versus the actual impact they're bringing to the organization? Another one is grassroots, not top-down. So to what extent is your organization focused on telling people the right answers and dictating the things that they should be doing versus really empowering people to problem solve and find better ways of doing things? So those 5 principles were really how I rounded out the quiz. But the other thing that's worth noting is I wrote the book not only for people who are in charge of organizations, and I didn't write the book solely for people who lead teams.
Mm.
I felt like it was important to really encompass the viewpoint of the individual. You know, so me showing up every day at work, I may not lead a team, I may not be a manager, I might be the lowest level of the organization. What can I do about this? And I still felt that there were things individuals could do that were within their power to create change in their work environment or for their personal situation. So the book is actually written for all 3 of those audiences, and each of the chapters talk to each one of those perspectives. So the quiz is also meant to pivot on those perspectives as well. And so when you take the quiz, you can look at it from the perspective of the individual and how well is the organization suited to the needs of the individual, and the team level and the broad organizational view. So that's why there's kind of two different lenses that I place on the quiz that enable you to kind of look at things from different perspectives to figure out, you know, where is my organization doing well and what are the biggest areas for improvement.
I was really impressed looking through those questions because all of them seemed important and things that I had noticed as problems in previous jobs I've had, but at the same time, it was a very long list. So I was like, wow, there's a lot going on at every place and there's a lot of opportunities for improvements. And it reminded me of one of my first full-time jobs. I was expected to wear a tie every day and I worked in information technology and I dealt with a lot of computers, some of which were very dusty. And I didn't have that many ties. I was like 22 years old and I didn't have the budget for dry cleaning. So I simply stopped wearing a tie because they were all getting kind of destroyed and nobody fired me. Nobody even said, hey, put back on the tie. And as a matter of fact, like 6 months later, they changed the dress code at the company.
That is hilarious. And why did they justify the tie to begin with? I mean, what do you think the rationale was?
I don't know. It was at a corporate headquarters and they didn't even really have clients coming through. I guess it was just a legacy thing.
Absolutely. And this is what amazes me about, you know, our tolerance for these things, that we're not standing up and going, hey guys, why are we doing this? Why are we torturing ourselves and contorting our bodies into these three-piece suits every day, you know, when there's really no real business need to do that? And I think there are actually very few jobs in which that should be a requirement. In fact, I'm hard-pressed to think of any at the moment, but that's just my perspective.
Yeah, right. I feel like I was born at a time to see that die. I don't know anybody else my age who has worked at a place where they were forced to wear a tie every day.
Absolutely. Well, when I first moved to New York last year from California, I was shocked. I would ride the subway in the morning and just be looking at all these guys around me in these suits with these ties. And I was just incredulous because I had come from the Silicon Valley where dress codes have pretty much been obliterated. I mean, and I'm sure there's places that they still have them. But for the most part, when you're working in the tech industry, they've all ditched the dress codes years ago. There's no way they can compete with talent if they're still expecting people to wear up, you know, khakis and polos every day. So it was just amazing to me to start to ride the subway and look around and be like, wow, this still exists? People are still doing this? Just blows my mind.
Let's talk again about scheduling a little bit. You've got an example in the book about Best Buy, which is a huge company, and they instituted a results-only work environment, which means that their corporate office employees have complete control over their schedule and the number of hours they work and where they work. How long has that been going on, first of all, and have you encountered anybody who actually has a negative opinion of it? How do we know that it's hard to imagine that working at such a large scale. I've worked at, you know, big companies and small companies, and I can see it working for a team of, I don't know, 24 people. But when you've got thousands, it just seems like a scheduling nightmare.
Right. Well, I mean, I think Best Buy has had that instituted for several years now. It's also interesting to note that Gap Outlet introduced that about, I think about 3 years ago, and I think Banana Republic then adopted it, and it's been slowly making its rounds through the Gap, all of the entities there. And I think it's also worth noting that they've done this in the corporate offices and not the retail locations, which is a very big distinction. So with retail locations, you obviously have some very real, or let's call it true urgency needs around scheduling. You need, you know, consistent people on the floor. You can't rely on people to show up and make sure that there's the right amount of coverage. So that, I get it. It makes sense that they haven't extended that to the retail environment. But in terms of the corporate offices, well, they're all knowledge workers. So these are folks who don't need to be available necessarily for set hours. Mm-hmm. They are doing work that has direct links to the business impact. And so when you have a knowledge-based environment without a lot of true urgency deadlines, you can let go of the reins a bit. But what's important to note is their relentless focus on impact. So if it's hard to track the impact of the work that people are doing, it's going to be hard to institute this, because what you're saying is we're letting go of the reins and letting people do whatever work activities they need to do to get to the impact, versus the opposite mentality, which is to say, these are the work activities that you will do in the hopes that it creates some impact. Mm-hmm. So you're essentially just reversing that equation. And if you are focusing on the impact, then it no longer matters how many hours it takes you to do, you know, to produce this result. If you find a way to automate it, then essentially, you know, you'd invest time automating it, and then all of a sudden the task takes no time. Well, you wouldn't be incentivized in an activity-based work environment to come up with that automation. You would just keep doing the activity. So it really does start focusing people on the things that matter in the business environment. And that focus on impact is really a big shift, but when you can get it right, it just creates such autonomy for individuals to do their work in the best way.
Okay.
And when that happens, what magically occurs is people will coordinate within teams to figure out when they need to have meetings, to coordinate on the collaborative pieces of work assignments, to make sure that everybody's pitching in to get the job done. And so that sense of accountability really becomes keen. Mm. Google didn't necessarily have the the result-only work environment methodology, but they didn't care when I showed up to work. They didn't care when I left. There were no time cards. There were no set schedules. You essentially just showed up and did the work you needed to do whenever you felt like you could do that. And I knew software engineers who didn't show up until 2 o'clock in the afternoon every single day, but they would work until midnight or 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
And that was just the schedule that worked for them, and they liked that. It was a routine schedule, but it was a very non-traditional routine schedule. So, you know, so that's essentially what the row work environment can produce. But, it is a very trepidatious, there's a lot of trepidation around saying, hey, we're going to ditch all these controls we have in place and just give people that freedom.
Right.
I mean, it's a big leap.
Would it be easier for a company to start out with all this flexibility and freedom versus an existing company trying to implement it, you know, midway through?
I think it's probably a safe assumption. I don't have data to back that up,
yeah.
But you know, you see startups who are adopting these more progressive management practices from day one, and that makes sense. They have fewer people. They're not trying to overcome the inertia of what's already going on in the organization and having to change assumptions and mentalities and philosophies and, you know, all these other things. So I think that just by the very nature of starting from scratch, it's a whole lot easier to make that happen. But there's certainly precedence for companies making that leap. Best Buy was, I think, such a quintessential example of that. And Gap switching over to that, again, it's a really good example of a success story of companies doing this. And there's plenty more examples that keep popping up over and over again.
In my head, I'm seeing a sort of teeter-totter balancing metaphor going on where if a company decides to give their employees a lot more freedom, the employees will start to act, I don't know, more adult or more motivated. They might even end up working longer hours, but feeling more accomplished and more responsible as a result.
Right. That's exactly right. Because when you give the freedom back to the employee to make the decisions, and they're compensated based on the impact they're creating, then you can see how it would just be intrinsically motivating to work more hours. Because I think a large problem in the way that most organizations are run is the work that I do goes into some black hole, and I don't even see the impact of my work.
Mm.
So when you have that disconnect, you have a sense of meaninglessness related to your work. So by very nature of saying, hey, now we're going to focus on impact, and then you give employees the visibility into the impact that they're creating, well, it's very motivating, very intrinsically motivating, which, you know, if you subscribe to the Drive book and all the concepts therein, it really is about trying to tap into people's intrinsic motivation versus trying to motivate them externally by money. So that kind of is consistent, I think, with a lot of the research and literature out there on motivation.
And I think there's also the aspect of motivating people to be more available to think about work in more places and at more times.
Mm-hmm. Like
we think of being on call as a total drag, but if you know that, you know, you're free to come and go whenever you want, it's not so bad to be checking your email while you're thinking about dinner.
Absolutely, because then you can start doing work based on when you're energized to be doing it. And if that means that you're crashing in the afternoon and you want to go home and take a nap, yeah, or you need to go, you know, to your child's school to see their school play, then, you know, logging back on at night is not a big deal, because you know that you are devoting in the hours when you have the freedom, when you have the energy to do those things. So absolutely, it becomes a whole lot more acceptable to the employee, I think, to give when you know you have the freedom to reel back in or to put out more based on what's going on personally in your life.
Tell me some of the other things you've learned about how humans have different ways of building up and then expending energy.
Well, I can only tell you based on my own personal experience. I've learned a lot. So when I did work at a traditional corporation, you know, their rules were maybe a little bit more lax than other companies, but essentially they said, you can set your hours, but just tell us what those hours will be, and then we'll expect you to stick to them. So that was, okay, fine, you can set your hours, but generally speaking, they'd want people to stay, you know, 9:30 to 5:30, or, you know, 9 o'clock to 5. So you're still, you know, there's still expectation that you would come in somewhat early, and that's early in my opinion. And when I had to adhere to that schedule, it induced a lot of stress, because, first of all, it still felt unnatural for me to get up at 6:30 in the morning so that I could commute in to make it in time to get there by 9:30. And then I had that pressure around getting there on time, even though it really made no difference at all whether I was in by 9 or 9:30 or 10. Nobody was waiting on me. You know, it absolutely had no impact whatsoever. So it was frustrating. It felt very stifling. And then worse, I was just exhausted all the time. I found it very hard to regulate my own energy, and I got sick all the time. Mm-hmm. I still have a propensity to get sick because I push myself very hard. But what I've noticed is now that I work in a place that doesn't dictate schedules, they don't care when you come in or leave, then when I'm not feeling well, I can just opt out and say, hey guys, I'm not feeling well. I'm going to work from home today and I'm going to sleep a little bit, but I'll be online later and work. And it's not that I have fewer times when I'm feeling run down, but I prevent it from being a full-on cold because I have that option. It really has helped me understand better my own energy cycles in terms of what works well for me. So the way that I do it is I don't show up in the office before 10 o'clock ever. Or, well, I can't say ever. I mean, right. It's very rare. You know, sometimes if it's needed, I will. But that's the cycle that works the best for me. And then I know that my energy cycle really kicks in at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock at night. And I can really plow on work at that point. And a lot of other people have left, which means I have quiet time. I have that mind space where I can really be creative and really be productive and know that I'm going to get a lot of stuff done. So that's kind of one piece of the puzzle for me. And then the other piece was when I was writing this book, I was holding a full-time job. And when you have two huge things in your life that, you know, you're committing to, it taught me to make some really hard choices around the things that I was doing in my life. And it forced me to pay incredibly close attention to my energy cycles.
At the very least, I'm going to assume you stopped watching TV entirely.
Absolutely. I could not watch TV. I couldn't go to movies. Yeah. I couldn't read, you know, pop culture magazines. I just had to completely eliminate those things from my life. And then I had to be ultra sensitive to my energy cycles. And what I found is that I couldn't work a full day's work and then come home during the week and work at night, or write at night, rather. So it was impossible for me to get into a cycle where I could work and then write. I had to use my evenings to really recharge, but then I found my weekends to be incredibly good time for writing because I could take, you know, a swath of 8 hours and basically pound out a full chapter during those 8 hours because it was intense focus and concentration. So, you know, it was kind of learning, wow, you know, these are the energy cycles of my body. This is what I can do. This is when I can focus. This is when I can't. And when you learn those things, it just becomes, it's amazing to see how much productivity you really can eke out of your system when you are paying attention to that energy.
Well, the book is deep and wide-ranging, and I hope that people take a look at it, especially some of my former bosses.
I can only imagine.
Thank you for writing it.
My pleasure.
That was Julie Klo, the author of The Work Revolution. Find more about the book at theworkrevolutionbook.com. Join us again next week for more great personal financial advice and information.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. We welcome your feedback. Please email us at podcast@consumerismcommentary.com. To subscribe to the podcast or to listen to this or other episodes, visit us at consumerismcommentary.com/pod or search for Consumerism Commentary on iTunes. The Consumerism Commentary Podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Dubeck, Brian J. Bush, and Luke Landis. The music is composed and performed by Mindcube. The podcast was founded by Luke Landis.